You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin continues to struggle with racial disparities when it comes to the well-being of kids. According to a report out today, we'll talk to the director of Kids Forward about some possible solutions.
First, if you're having trouble finding a house or apartment that you can afford, you're not alone. Lots of low-income and middle-income Americans are in the same boat, with housing costs putting a strain on their budgets.
And things may be getting worse. A new report from the housing agency Freddie Mac shows a big drop in affordable apartment availability from 2010 to 2016. And here in Wisconsin's real estate market, home prices have been steadily rising since the Great Recession, with big jumps in some urban areas.
Our next guest says federal housing policy may be making things worse, and she's hoping some changes that will help make housing more affordable.
Michelle Dickerson is a University Distinguished Teaching Professor and Arthur L. Moeller Chair in Bankruptcy Law and Practice at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law. She's the author of Home Ownership and America's Financial Underclass, Flawed Premises, Broken Promises, New Prescriptions, and her forthcoming book is called The Neglected Middle Class, Inequality, Race, and the Looming Economic Crisis. Michelle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on again.
How big a problem, Michelle, is housing affordability for low and middle income Americans?
It's a significant problem, and I think we actually now can safely use the word crisis to describe what's going on with affordable housing. You know, when we typically think of affordable housing, at least, 15, 20 years ago, we thought of it for just the poorest of our Americans. But now it's affecting the very poor, the moderately poor, people that are just below the poverty line, and also the middle class. It's a crisis that's affecting a significant swath of America.
And sometimes in the past, it seems like we've had a problem with mortgages and home costs, but not renting, or vice versa. Now it looks like it's both. Rents are high and home costs are high.
Exactly. And one of the reasons that rents are actually soaring is because of home prices. So during the recession, we had far too many, especially middle-income homeowners, to lose their homes. They can't afford to buy a house because, as you just mentioned, in Wisconsin and across the country, housing prices are soaring. Well, guess what? If they can't afford to buy a house, they then enter the rental market. Because they're middle income, they can afford, they have a little bit more flexibility in where they can live than our poorest citizens, which means they're driving up the prices of rent. So they can't afford to buy a home because home prices are rising, but when they enter into the rental market, they cause those prices to rise too.
Are there some areas feeling this more than others? We hear about San Francisco's and Seattle's where costs are being driven up in part as a story of success in high-tech industries. Is this a really localized problem in some places, or are we seeing this in a lot of places in the country?
We're seeing it all over the country. I mean, there are some places where, and San Francisco is either the best or the worst, depending on how you want to characterize it, example. It is virtually impossible for a middle-income family to afford to buy a home in San Francisco. Now, that's not the case all across the country, but we are seeing larger percentages of both middle-class Americans and also poor, lower-income Americans. They can't find a place to buy, and they can't find an affordable place to rent. It's everywhere.
And a big question is, can I afford a place to live near, reasonably near, where I can, say, work?
Exactly. And so you have people, especially on the sort of the coast, having commutes of, in excess of an hour. That causes all sorts of problems, especially if we think in terms of a school teacher. So if you have a school teacher that works an hour from the school he or she teaches in, what that means is it's not likely that they're going to be able to come in before school for tutoring, stay after school for tutoring, or to go support their students in after-school activities. It has all sorts of collateral effects when people are having to live so far from where they work.
We're talking to law professor Michelle Dickerson from the University of Texas, looking at housing affordability and unaffordability, renting and buying in the United States. And Michelle, you look a lot at how things like federal tax policies and other policies help or maybe more often hurt the situation. What do you see as the biggest problems at the federal level?
The biggest problem right now is the mortgage interest deduction. If you look at the fact that we spend about $70 billion on the mortgage interest deduction, but we're actually subsidizing the housing cost of high-income Americans. And the reason that the benefit only goes to higher-income Americans is because you only get the mortgage interest deduction if you itemize your deductions. Most Americans, 70% of Americans, take the standard deduction. So the only people that are going to itemize are people that have a pretty significant sized mortgage and that they have enough interest that it would warrant itemizing rather than taking the standard deduction.
Right. The big argument for that mortgage interest deduction, as I've heard it, is it's for that family, say, who's right on the border of being able to afford that house. This gives them the extra little nudge, an extra little bonus on their tax bill that helps push them over the top and be able to buy that house. You're saying they're not the ones who are benefiting, really?
Those are not the ones who are benefiting. The ones who are benefiting are because the larger your mortgage, the more interest you pay, the more valuable that deduction is. If we are clearly skewing housing decisions by telling people who earn over $200,000, buy a big house, get a big mortgage, you get a bigger deduction.
Let's stay with this for a bit. What do you see as a policy fix to that? What could change so that this program that's supposed to target people in the middle class, maybe lower middle class even, actually helps them more than people who are wealthier?
Well, there are a couple of, I think, pretty quick fixes. And for the first time, I will say ever, and I've been studying this for a while, I feel somewhat more optimistic that we may have some modifications to the mortgage interest deduction. So you can deduct interest on up to $1 million of debt. Most middle-income families, poor families, they don't have $1 million mortgage. They don't pay interest on $1 million mortgage. So reduce, you know, cap the amount of the mortgage that you can claim interest on. Currently, you can claim interest on both your primary residence and a second home. Eliminate the provision where you're allowing rich people who have two homes to be able to deduct interest on their second home. I mean, those are a couple of just really quick tweaks that we should be able to do, and the majority of Americans will not be harmed.
That's aimed at the middle class. Now, let's look at lower income people. When people think about government affordable housing programs, that's maybe what they think of, Section 8 housing. You've talked lately, you were on a panel for members of Congress recently talking about some related issues here, misconceptions that people in the public, maybe even policymakers, have about who is getting this Section 8 home support for low-income people.
Exactly. And even when you say the term Section 8, in people's minds, they have this vision of who the person is that's receiving this housing choice subsidy. They think they're lower income. They think they're a person of color. They probably think they're black. And they also think that they're receiving this housing handout because they refuse to get a job. And as I said in the congressional briefing I recently participated in, only one of those things is true. You're right. For a person to receive a housing choice voucher, they have to be poor. But more than 50% of the people that are, you know, Section 8 tenants are white, and 70% of the people who receive this housing subsidy either currently work or have recently worked. So it's not that they're getting an unearned handout. They're actually, these are working members of our communities.
Does this kind of housing assistance for low-income people actually help them find decent housing?
For those that are actually able to get the voucher, yes, it typically has. The problem is most people that are eligible to receive the housing voucher aren't able to get it because there's just not enough money to fund the program. And the other challenge is something that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, that we are having fewer low-income housing units to actually be built. So we have a challenge of the renters. You know, the renter market is being flooded by mid-income people who lost their homes, and there's just not enough of the affordable housing being built. And so even the people who have the housing choice vouchers may not be able to find a place to live.
Law professor Michelle Dickerson is with us from the University of Texas. We're looking at the high cost of housing in the United States, renting and buying, and why home ownership and rent payments can be a big burden for low and middle income Americans.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this your story? Have you had trouble finding housing that you can afford in the community you want to live in? What role, if any, should the government play in helping provide affordable housing? You can call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle-Larson. We're continuing our conversation with law professor Michelle Dickerson at the University of Texas, looking at the high costs of rent and home ownership.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Is this your life right now, trying to find housing, a rental, or buying a house that you can actually afford? What's happening in your community when it comes to the costs of housing? Are you commuting longer, a lot longer than you would like to, maybe? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Michelle, before we go to our callers, are there ethnic and racial disparities when it comes to housing and housing policies, for that matter?
Well, there are clear disparities, at least with respect to the mortgage interest deduction and home ownership rates. As I mentioned earlier, the taxpayers who are most likely to take the mortgage interest deduction are higher income taxpayers. Because white families have higher household incomes on average than black and Latino families, what that means is it is statistically more likely that the person that takes the mortgage interest deduction that benefits from this $70 billion housing subsidy will be white. And also, if you just look at sort of our nation's not really good history with respect to housing, after World War II, after the Depression, when the United States was engaging in really massive efforts to get Americans into homes, the Americans that were able to buy homes and were able to move to the suburbs to buy high appreciating homes were white Americans. Redlining and a lot of other federal policies kept blacks out of the home buying market at that time, and as a result, they've lost decades of wealth.
Is there a way to turn that around in the short term?
Not in the short term. We're not going to sort of undo 50 years of wealth loss, but one thing I'll stress is we don't need to continue to make it worse. So to the extent that the mortgage interest deduction in its current form is making it worse, at a bare minimum, we need to stop that and then try to work on policies to close that gap.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. David is with us in northern Minnesota. David, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple of questions. First one is where your guest gets the figures. Most homeowners who own their own homes have incomes slightly below $50,000 a year, and that certainly seems to be a reasonable income to have a home. The second thing is I do not understand why or how removing a tax deduction on a second home is going to help the low and middle income people get a home who currently do not have a home. That's if your guest wants support from a wider audience to enable low income people to get homes, goring the ox of the people who have a second home by taking away that second mortgage just doesn't make any sense at all.
David, thanks for calling in. So let's start with that second point. David's saying don't take away the mortgage interest deduction on those second homes. He doesn't see how it connects to helping people who can't afford a home.
Well, the connection is, I'm actually glad he asked that question. The connection is until we eliminate some part of the $70 billion that we're currently using to subsidize housing, Congress simply isn't going to have the will to allocate more funds to low-income housing. I mean, it is a zero-sum game. If they're spending $70 billion, which they're currently spending on the mortgage interest deduction. They're not also going to spend $70 billion as a tax expenditure for low-income housing. If I thought they would do both, I would agree completely with the caller, but I think it's just a reality that they're not. The amount of money that they've allocated now for low-income housing is less than half of the amount that we spend on the mortgage interest deduction.
And then David said most or many homeowners are earning $50,000 or less. I don't know what the numbers are on that, but if that's the case, those are people who wouldn't probably be helped by the mortgage interest deduction because they'd be taking the standard deduction.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call, David, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Michelle Dickerson, professor of law at the University of Texas, looking at the costs of housing, housing affordability, or lack of same. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you're going through this, having trouble finding some place to rent or buy that you can afford. Back to our callers now, Bob in the Mount Horeb area. Bob, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Michelle, I don't know if you speak about this in your book or your work, but property taxes are forcing homeowners out of their homes. And property taxes in Madison are a definite burden to a homeowner. You got to come up with almost $5,000 for a decent home. That's around $225,000 or more. And then when they reassess property.
Oop, I think we lost you, Bob, but I think we got your point. Michelle, Bob saying property taxes are a part of the affordability problem. Where do they fit in?
It clearly, definitely is a part of the affordability problem. And if we can sort of link back to places like San Francisco or places where home prices keep increasing, it's great for the existing homeowners that, A, see their wealth increase, and, B, can afford to pay the property taxes on the homes. For people who can't and they want to sell their homes, they may not be able to buy anything in their area because of the fact that property taxes are increasing. So he makes a great point. The crisis is both related to property taxes increasing. It's related to housing prices increasing. And also one thing we really haven't talked about, it's related to the fact that for most middle-class workers, they haven't seen a significant raise in decades.
Thanks a lot for that call. We also heard from Dennis, who couldn't stay on the line. Dennis says he's in the lower class income level. He was weighing renting versus buying, decided it made more sense to buy, but partly because of his income level, he was held back from buying something and getting that mortgage because of his credit score. So let's talk about credit as part of this equation on finding housing, Michelle. Where does that fit in?
Well, one of the other things that happened in the recession is a lot of people who defaulted on mortgages or who are in default now on their student loans, they have bad credit. So I'm not suggesting that we do the same thing that caused the housing bubble to burst to begin with. We don't need to create mortgage products that get people into homes only to have them lose the homes in 2 or 3 years. But we do need to take care with what's included in a credit score. And if there are things that really have little to do with the person's ability to qualify for a loan and to repay the loan, we need to make sure that what's included in your credit score is not holding you back.
And let's throw in another kind of loans, student loan debt. That's been cited as a factor that's preventing people from home ownership. How does that prevent people from getting into housing?
Not only is it preventing people from home ownership, it's preventing the people that should be buying homes. So recent college graduates, or the trajectory 20 or 30 years ago is you graduate from college, you get married, you buy a home, or you get married, you have a child, you buy a home. The problem now is a lot of, especially the millennials, can't afford to buy a home because they're buried in student loan debt. Both, and it's especially a problem for people who attended college but didn't graduate. So they're stuck with the student loan repayments, but they didn't get the income boost that they would have received if they'd stayed in college for all 4 years. So if you're buried in debt with your student loans, you're not likely going to be able to, or you're not likely going to want to, take on mortgage debt.
Michelle, you started to touch on this earlier, but do you see an appetite out there to solve the problem of housing affordability? Obviously, a lot of individual people are feeling this. Is it emerging as a policy issue that lawmakers want to tackle?
It is. And I've been talking about sort of the mortgage interest reduction and why I felt we needed to that as a matter of policy, we needed to modify it for decades, over 10 years. And usually I'm lined up on the opposite side from the home builders, the mortgage bankers, and the realtors. For the first time ever, the builders and the mortgage bankers are willing to talk about potential modifications to the mortgage interest deduction. Now, the realtors are still on the other side, but this is a seismic shift to have these two national organizations saying, look, this is a crisis, and we need to be creative in how we're going to fix it.
And do you see other people starting to agree with you that, apart from the groups you just mentioned, that this is a crisis situation and should be treated accordingly?
Yes, and the interesting thing is it's both from the left and the right. So traditionally, when the sort of small band of us would say that the mortgage interest deduction isn't good, usually the response is, but it helps people buy homes. We now know that's not true. Rich people will buy homes with or without the deduction, and people that take the standard deduction don't get any benefit from itemizing. And we also see now the quite stark wealth inequities, both between the middle class and the upper class, and also between white homeowners and Black and Latinos who either are homeowners or can't afford to buy homes. So I think there's I'm more optimistic now, not completely, but I'm more optimistic now that there may be some more of an appetite in Congress to look at this, because the affordability crisis is just that. It's not just affecting the poor. It's an American crisis.
Michelle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Michelle Dickerson, law professor at the University of Texas and author of the book Home Ownership and America's Financial Underclass, Flawed Premises, Broken Promises, New Prescriptions. She joined us for a look at the high cost of housing.